This is HPR episode 1851 entitled HPR Community News for August 2015 and is part of the series HPR Community News. It is hosted by HPR volunteers and is about 114 minutes long. The summary is HPR Community News for August 2015.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
My name is Ken Fallon. You're listening to Hacker Public Radio Community News for August 2015. Joining me tonight are from top to bottom. John, this is where you introduce yourself.
Oh, sorry, I couldn't see the screen. I'm looking at the web browser. This is John Culp in Lafayette, Louisiana.
Hello, this is Dave Morris in Edinburgh.
And this is Ken Fallon in Bissum in the Netherlands. Anyway, for those of you who have never heard of HPR or the community news, HPR is a community podcast where the people listening to the shows contribute to the shows. More about that later. Also, the community news is a little bit of a rundown, a bit of a sync for everybody on what's been going on, and a heads up on stuff that we need to talk about. And one of those things is the amount of people contributing shows and why, basically, you haven't contributed a show. We will be pointing to individuals during this, so feel free to listen along to see if you're picked out. We usually start by going introducing the new hosts for the last month and going through last month's shows. So Dave, even though these two I can probably pronounce, I think it would be better if you did.
Okay. New hosts in August have been A Shadowy Figure and Folky.
Two excellent names there. So let's go through quickly the shows that have been on for this month, and we will discuss any comments that we come across as well. The first one of the month is the HPR Community News, which, as I said before, is a community news, anything that's going in and around the community being the shows themselves, the mailing list, which anyone's free to join, and stuff that's been emailed to the admin mailing list, which while anyone's free to join, we do want to make sure that it's people who are known to the community and stuff, so that we're not starting international incidents. People who are known to the community, who's helped out us, who've done a few shows will help, who we've met at various different conferences and stuff like that. So comments for this month, there was no comments on this show itself. So then the following day we had How Do I Make Bread? Dave Morris.
Yes, well, this was in response to some guy called Ken Fallon who'd been asking about bread making. And so I told everybody how I made mine, and I think a few people enjoyed it anyway.
It is absolutely a very, very excellent show, and unfortunately I didn't get a chance to make it myself as yet, and as yet being the optimum term, but it is, the show notes are again excellent, Dave. I really like the Image Magic 1, 2, 3, 4 thing that you've done on top.
You can tell I actually got another show out of that, because I did a show on how I made the images for that one.
But excellent. And again, one of these where I am just kind of sorry that we don't have like smell-o-vision or taste-o-vision to go along with it.
And this was really good. You know, there was a time when my wife used to make bread all the time, probably 2 or 3 loaves a week, and man, it was excellent. But as we get older and busier and the kids grow up, we find that we don't have much time to do it. But love hearing about how people make bread. It's So thank you very much for that episode, Dave. That was great.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I'm going to try and get my wife to do an episode on the two recipes she's actually settled on as a result of her own investigations.
It can take a while to settle on a favorite recipe. There's a whole lot of trial and error and definitely a lot of hacking going on, you know, when you're finding recipes and adjusting to suit. I've always said that my mother is one of the greatest hackers I've ever known because of the way that her cookbook has so many alterations written into all of the recipes. And when I make stuff from my youth, I always want to check with my mom, too. So I use her hacked recipes rather than the ones that are written verbatim in the cookbook.
Yeah, that's, RMS uses that analogy quite a lot to explain. But apparently a lot of people are claiming copyright on their recipes now as well.
Rotten.
There you go. The following day we had a very timely one.
Did you, hold on, Ken, did you want to do the comments on that one?
Oh, of course I did. Of course I did, Dave. Sorry.
So although perhaps I shouldn't, I'll start by saying...
How about I do you... I'll do...
You do them, that would be
and
better.
And then you can do your own feedback if you want. Okay, this was Charlie Egbert. Love the episode. He uses wax paper to cover the wok and line pan for baking to keep the bread from sticking. He has a couple of bread makers around, but doesn't use them anymore other than kneading the bread. They knead the bread quite well and keep it slightly elevated temperature, which is nice. He'll also have a look around for some of the ingredients, assuming the FDA hasn't banned them. Interesting show. He also likes watching Alien Bob from Slackware fame post his bread experiments on the web. He also bakes. Very hackery thing to do. And then Daniel Worth from the Open Musicians podcast. I make a lot of food from scratch. He also makes a sourdough. He loves hearing other people's process of cooking. Did a fantastic job on the episode, to which you replied.
Well, I said to the two commenters, thank you very much for the comments. And to Charlie, I said I'd never thought of using wax paper. I think it's the same as what we call greaseproof paper in the UK.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But never, it's such a pain to get into bread tins, I find. But and I've never used the knead-only program for my bread maker, although I think my son's used it, but I'm not sure. You could make a pizza or something with that. But yeah, so good luck with finding the ingredients. I'm sure it doesn't matter that much, but you know, it's nice if you can get a bit of variety in bread making. And to Daniel,
sorry, go ahead, Dave.
I was just going to say to Daniel, I said I'd like to hear about how he makes sourdough bread, because that's always an interesting subject.
I was just about to say that I didn't realize that bread makers could do just the kneading, but not the rest of it. So we've never had a bread maker.
It's a good thing to invest in. As I said in the episode, as life got busier for me, I bought one and used that as my main route for making bread. So and they're not fantastically expensive, and they're very good nowadays. So it's maybe something to consider if you enjoy, you know, having your own homemade bread.
When my wife was doing the test,
maybe.
Sorry. Yeah, my wife had it for a while, and she basically. Occasionally, one time out of 20, it wouldn't mix right, and just all the dough would be, all the flour would be on the bottom, and just be a big mess. So she went to Kenwood then.
My bread maker gets a little bit sulky sometimes with certain types of flour. I think it depends on the wetness of the dough and weird things like that. So I always check it as it's kneading stuff, and if it's not behaving itself, I give it a wee poke to make it pick up all the flour so it doesn't so it does what it's supposed to do. So, but it needs watching, which is sort of goes against the grain a bit. It goes against that was a bad pun. But it goes against the principle of the process.
Okay, moving on to the following day. John, were you finished?
No, it's all good. Go ahead.
People who are listening and wondering why we're cutting in on each other, we're different parts of the world and time lag can cause issues, so it's not intentional that I'm speaking over other people, except for Dave, of course.
Of course.
And my Bill, who I'm trying to secretly coax into doing more shows on electronics, basic electronic stuff, but I really liked his multimeter mod one. And I've since started using started watching a YouTube series, which I will talk about later in an episode that I have coming up. And this looks like a really, really nice multimeter for about $50.
Yeah, you can get it in the UK too. I checked up on that. It does look quite desirable. I was tempted to buy one.
I just wish I knew how to use the multimeter that I have. I mean, I can test for continuity and stuff, but I don't really understand everything about it. I loved hearing him talk about the hack that he did to this, though, to open it up and install a backlight and all of that stuff. I just love that.
Yeah, that appealed a lot to me. It's great to have a thing and then think, oh, it's not doing quite what I want, and then go in there and change it, make it work. That's true hacking. Fantastic.
If you go to a guy called MJLORTON, MJ Lorton, he's a South African gentleman, and he does... I'll paste it into the mumble chat here. If you go to that guy's website on YouTube, or you know, YouTube's site, he does a lot of multimeter reviews. The guy has a fascination for multimeter reviews, and he also does introduction to, you know, testing voltage, and he's done a few introduction series. Basically, he's been on there since 2010, so he's got an awful lot of episodes, and I'm working through them slowly, but. Very good at just explain anything you want to know about multimeters, what you should look for, the differences in price ranges, and you know, how to look at what the percentage means and what the numbers of digits means and all that sort of stuff. So that's what I've been watching all week.
Excellent. Yeah, thanks for the tip. I'm going to check that out.
But as I say that, I will be doing a show on my YouTube subscriptions later on, and the script that I bash script have written to do it. Sorry, Dave, you were saying?
No, I was just going to agree with John saying something about how to use a multimeter would be very nice to hear. I have one, an old one with an analog one with a needle on it, and I've used it in the past, but I don't really know how to use it all that well. So yeah, agree.
And
I've used mine a couple of times just to see how much. I've used it a few times to check how much power my batteries are putting out. Used it on my car and on some just like AA batteries and stuff like that. But the kinds of things Bill's talking about using it for, I just don't understand. I think either something like these YouTube videos you're talking about, or even some HPR episodes by NY Bill or someone else on just basic use of one of these things would be excellent.
Yes, absolutely. NY Bill, I hope you're listening. John, you posted a comment saying amazing job. One of my favorite shows in the year. Looking forward on hearing this becoming a series. See, I've cloned another you owe me a show person. To which NYB replied, thanks, Paul. I thought I'd record an episode while I was doing a project. Talk as you go. My thought process, troubleshooting, etc. Although I felt the edit was a bit rough. I'm glad you like it. And you should absolutely not be... worried about things being rough. What I found interesting about a lot of these episodes is you're sitting down and you come across a problem, and then comes back with a fix and goes, okay, well, I'm not going to be able to do that. And that's pretty much how a lot of my projects go. You start something, it doesn't work out, you stop for a while, life catches up, then you go back to it, and sometimes you finish it, sometimes you don't.
I agree. In the episode I just uploaded yesterday, there is a major disappointment about 6 minutes into the episode that I then will rectify later. So I decided to keep that whole thing in the recording anyway.
Excellent. Excellent. Looking forward to that. As you know, I don't listen to shows until they're released. Speaking of shows that you have released, episode 1829 was my new used Kindle DX. You got this at the Goodwill,
didn't you? Starting to think... not at the Goodwill, no. I got this one. I wish. I got this one on Amazon. Yeah, I paid good money for this one. It was $128 on Amazon used, but I found out that they retailed originally for nearly $500 after I poked around a bit. But yeah, I'm just kind of a degenerate for ebook devices. And so I got this even though I already had two other Kindles.
But this looks like a fantastic... a fantastic one, because the guy who I mentioned, his one of his projects is trying to charge. He's into solar panels and stuff, and living off the grid. And one of his projects is trying to charge this exact Kindle using solar panels and supercapacitors.
And, sweet.
Yeah, but it goes wrong in so many ways. So he's got 16, 17 different episodes on this alone. But it's great because you're going through the, you know, people just put up the YouTube videos. Here, I made this simple circuit and this is how it works. And, you know, you can see his iterations as he goes through. And it's fantastic as somebody interested in electronics to, well, I tried this and then this happened. All right, and then you're going to see how I'm going to fix that. And it turns into a mess. And then he just goes back to basics at the end. So it's excellent. Well worth the watch.
Yeah, well, as I tell my students, you learn a whole lot more from mistakes than you do from doing it right the first time. So maybe that's what this guy's going on.
And the comments to this show was from Freeweeb? F Foxtrot Whiskey Echo Echo Bravo. BQ caveats. You mentioned that you were looking for an unaffiliated e-reader. How about the BQ
Cervantes.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you. It is a touch expensive, but it is unaffiliated, and as a bonus, the version I've linked to runs open source Slack. I don't have one, but I'm awfully tempted.
Yeah, I don't have the Cervantes, and I looked at the link that he put in there, and it certainly looked really interesting, but it's not available over here. I would have to order it from Europe and have it sent here.
It's 139 euros.
Yeah, it's a little pricey.
6-inch e-screen, front light technology, no reflection, only 185 grams, 8 gig of internal RAM, 1,500 milliamp hour ion battery, developed in Spain. It's got Spanish, Basque, Catalan, English, Galicia, and Portuguese. Wi-Fi 802.11bg, micro SD, USB 2, dictionary, several dictionaries, compatible with EPUB, PDF, DRM, PB2, MOBI, DOC, TFF, and text files. PDF files with DRM, that's interesting. How do they manage that in free product?
It's very strange. I mean, it does look like a great device. I'd love to have one, but I'm probably not going to order one.
If anyone has one, please do a review.
And then send it to me.
Apparently, Cyber Gurg, Dave.
Cyber Guru, I think that one is.
Thank you. Do you want to read this then?
You've been eaten by a guru, I imagine that is. But anyway, yeah. Says one thing you missed. Another good show, John. One thing about the Kindle DX that you missed is that it can display full-size PDF documents without resizing them or reflowing. That's quite unusual, I'd have thought. It works great for technical PDFs like scientific papers with embedded graphics and graphs, for example. It can handle very large PDF documents, but changing pages is very slow. Also, it can display other formats as well, plain ASCII text, for example. On mine, there is an experimental features menu item that claims it can retrieve web pages via cellular. I think I've never used this feature, so I don't know if or how well it works. The DX appears to have been an attempt at a professional version of the Kindle and appears to have features that were not on other Kindles, which explains its price and short life. That's interesting.
Yeah, and I commented after that, yeah, I did forget to, I forgot to talk about the PDF capabilities, and it's probably because I tried this and I didn't really like PDFs on this all that much either. I mean, it's better than on a small Kindle, but I still didn't like it all that much. It's not too bad for musical scores. I loaded up some scores on there in PDF format, and it looked pretty good. One downside of the PDF on that device was that you could not access any embedded table of contents that might be there, which is something that I talked about on a previous episode that I did about PDF TK, how you can embed tables of contents. And once I've done that, I want to have access to it. And so this thing doesn't give me access to that table of contents, so it's not that great. The experimental web browser that he mentioned is something that I've not used on this Kindle DX because the wireless doesn't work. But I've used it quite a lot on my other Kindle, my Kindle Paperwhite. And actually what I use it for is to access my book collection, which I have on my Raspberry Pi, and I serve it up using the Calibre library server that's built into the Calibre program. And I can access my whole Calibre library from the Raspberry Pi in this web browser and then download books straight to my Kindle from that.
That is a very powerful program. Okay, so, there was also a comment. Did you already reply to the comments that you replied back to? Did you cover it?
I think so.
Okay, shall we move on to the next one?
Yeah, that's enough about mine.
No, it's one of mine. How Holland Works Green Wheels, yeah. This is a show that, a series actually I want to start that Dave has asked for, which is, you know, basically an outsider's view of Holland. And as I mentioned during the episode, I'm here so long, I don't know if I necessarily find any of this stuff interesting or, you know, weird or not anymore. But it is, and this episode I tried to record 17 times, and for some reason, sometimes you're doing an episode and it just gets jinxed. And so I went down and just did it.
I really liked this one. I mean, I don't think we have any service like this in the region where I live, but I've heard about it in places up in the Northeast. Not this particular system, but some kind of car rental system that works in basically the same way. And my solution for not having a second car was just to buy a second car. but that's a forthcoming episode. But I really thought this was interesting.
Yeah, and as I said, go on.
Sorry. No, I was just going to agree and say, yeah, thanks very much for that. It was an interesting insight. I quite like the graphics too, actually.
I mean, it's dead simple to use. But again, it just happens to be where I live. We live in Bussum is pretty close, 20 minutes from Amsterdam, and you know, the other side, the whole coast of what people tend to know as Holland, the province of Holland, is very well served with public transport. So it works here. But if I was living anywhere else, you'd still have to have a car. And when we were in England, we had two cars even. So it is just lucky that I can do that.
I'm curious, are all the cars essentially the same kind of car, or do they have things like pickup trucks that you could rent for an hour and move a large item somewhere and then take it back?
Yeah, we don't tend to have pickup trucks per se in Europe at all. And any pickup trucks that there are people who have imported them from the States, and they keep them pristine so they don't dare to put anything into them. but they do have like station wagons, and the station wagons are kind of larger vehicles that you can fit 7 people into, and you can flip the back seat over and, you know, put in a large pallet of stuff into it. And those ones are only in the bigger towns, but you know, you're still within 10 kilometers of one or two of those in any of the towns around. So here I would need to cycle down 5 kilometers to the nearest town and grab that one from there, and then use that. But that then is slightly more expensive to rent.
Interesting.
But it's amazing what you can fit into the back of one of these things. And I've had times where I needed to move larger amount of stuff, and then it just becomes cheaper to rent a van for a day.
Yeah, even over here you can rent a truck for a day a whole lot cheaper than you can buy a new one.
Yeah, exactly. And we did the maths on it, because I did have a car when I moved here first, and you know, I used to wash my car every month because me, and I had washed it twice without actually having driven it, so it had been out there for 3 months. So we did the maths on how much it was costing us for, you know, tax, doing the, you know, emissions test, the MOT, or the whatever it's called here. And APICA is what it's called here. And just, it didn't make any sense. If we had paid a taxi to bring us for the amount of times that we've used it, we would still be in, you know, it would still be making money if we had used a taxi for everything. So, yeah. It's a no-brainer, get rid of the car.
Yeah, well, I wish it were that easy here. Sadly, where I live, the cars are necessary. I mean, we only just recently got the second one, but we'll talk more about that in a little bit.
So the 5150 says, Shukin, I thought this was your long-promised description how windmill and the dike system works. Windmills, I have recorded. Yes, I have not edited it, but it's on the list. The dike system, I actually was going to record in a place, but it was out with the family, and I thought, nah, it's more appropriate to be a dad, so sometimes. And Dave, you mentioned, do you want to read it yourself, or...?
Just to say that it was interesting to have that sort of insight into how things are done in other parts of the world. And we do have a city car scheme here in Edinburgh, pretty similar, I think. Though I don't think it's quite as sophisticated, but I've never used it, so I don't actually know. It's quite common for people in the city itself not to have their own transport, just use that for a similar argument to the one you made.
Yeah, actually. But there you go. The following day we had new host, a shadowy figure. Our speed listening and show background music compatible. Excellent show. Well done. Although he criticized my episode on my life hack and how to tell your left and right earbud apart. I'm offended, sir. I'm offended.
I thought you would have been delighted because it did just what you wanted to do.
Yes. Yes, that's true. But actually, I'm serious. I really think that's a good life hack. I use that every day, just as a by-the-by.
It is a good life hack. On my own earbuds, I don't have to do that because they're the kind that sling and sit over your ear with these little hooks, and so it's easier to tell which one is which based on that.
And John, you replied to this?
Yeah, he asked... I guess he was asking somewhere in the podcast about how fast people like to listen to these things, and so I replied 1.7x. That's how fast I normally listen to, although I mentioned that if the focus of the show is music, then I will listen at normal speed. So for the Bugcast, for example, I listen at normal speed, and any podcast I listen to where they're just talking and music isn't the focus of the show, I go 1.7.
I will be more or less the same. I'll be 1.82, and then down to, you know, I have a separate queue for music shows. And he replied to that saying, thank you, John. I find your contributions both entertaining, informative. Royalty-free music isn't generally what I'd like to focus on, but rather some sort of ambience for background to add something to the entertainment value of presentations or even transitional segments that includes musical or other forms of non-vocal cues between thoughts or segments. In essence, adding some color to the audio presentation, think Radiolab or This American Life, etc. I personally feel adding this sort of elements may encourage casual hit-and-run listeners to tune in again, not only for the educational content, but for the entertainment as well. Thanks again, John. And Windigo just commented on the 1.5x. He started speeding up podcasts at work. He keeps them at 1.5x, although some have gone up to 2x. And just on my personal feeling, and we've had debates on this topic about whether to put music into the into shows or not, as bedding music into shows or not. Splitting up segments, I don't think anybody has a problem with them in splitting up segments, but there are two trails of thought about whether you should put music as bedding music. And there are, as HPR admin, there's been a lot of discussion on this. Speaking with my HPR admin hat on now officially, there have been two trails of thought discussing on the mail list, and if you want to discuss this, feel free to open the topic on the mail list. But taking my HBR hat on and putting my podcast listeners hat on for a moment here, just to be very, very clear, there is never a good reason for putting bedding music in a podcast. Stop it right now!
I have to agree with that. I don't like to have bedding music either. I do like bumper music between segments.
Yes.
But I don't like to have music going on while people are talking.
It's
agree.
I had a Twitter fight with Dan from Rattle Radio when he started putting in bedding music in the background. It was really, really, really annoying.
It's surprising that Dan would do that. I mean, I haven't listened to Rattle Radio in a very long time, but they never used to do that on Linux Outlaws.
But then that's a music show, and a lot of people liked it because they listen in bars and listening live, so there's, you know, a bit of jive going on in the background. They're in the zone, whereas I'm listening in work, and it just distracts.
Yeah, and it really gets annoying if you're listening at high speed.
Absolutely. And speeding it up to 1.7 won't do anything. It also just makes it very difficult to listen to a show, especially when you... All my shows, not only do I speed it up to 1.82 or something like that, I will also switch it down to mono so that I can listen in one ear. So, and the reason I do that is if there's a delay on the trains or anything, you're listening, you take out one ear and you're listening to the announcements going past on the public, you know, public address system, which can be very, very, very crappy by times. So anything, then you're not able to pick up the podcast. It's just too much going on. So it's very frustrating.
It sounds like you might need to try out remember my episode about headphones? One of them was these bone conduction things, which are great for that kind of situation because your ears are still wide open.
When I heard that, I did stop it and make a note of the model numbers to go and give it a shout. But on the other hand, there is a lot of times where I don't want to be hearing what people are saying on the train.
Very true.
So yes, but the Shadowy Figure, excellent show, and I love your icon. Please, anybody help me. Avatar, that's the one.
Knew you'd get there in the end.
It took a while. We covered all the comments on that, did we, Dave?
Yes, I think we did.
Dave is distracted because I told him my SQL script earlier on. So if you ever want to distract Dave, just tell him, Dave, how would you do this? And then come back in a half an hour.
I'm trying really hard not to be distracted. It's not working, mind you.
The following day was How I Use Markdown and Pandoc in Writing Workflow by Be Easy. And I know it's Be... Why do we have a alternative text link in there for images? Oh, because it's doing what it's supposed to do. Okay, fine. Sorry, in the show notes. And this is a episode about Pandoc, a tool that I had no clue existed, but kind of thinking that it might make a way into our... automating workflow. Would now be a good time to talk about that discussion we had offline, David?
Certainly, if you want to. Yes, I think it's a good subject. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so we've done a lot of work on automating stuff, and one of the main things that we've done has been the web upload thing, which has made sure that every... the format, at least, for all the questions, has your intro been added, has your outro been added, has your summary been added, that sort of thing, that there's always a title of the correct length, that there's always a synopsis, and the show notes and stuff was always there. So that's really helped a lot. So people are wondering, has been asked on IRC, and also Dave has been asking, why does it sometimes take a long time for shows to be posted and sometimes it doesn't? And the answer to that is because the process of posting the shows is still it's still me doing it. And Dave is offered to help, and that's fine. But there is a human doing it. And the reason there's a human doing it is because the show notes themselves come in different formats. Let's put it like that. Sometimes they come up in text. Sometimes people send them in as TZ files, Dave.
Good and some, gracious
sometimes
me, how
people
that be?
Say, I have uploaded the show notes to the FTP server, Dave. So everybody has their own way of doing it, which are all valid and correct ways, and we're very happy to get the show notes. But we're working through a process of how it was actually Dave and I are going through all the old show notes to see if there's a way that we can automate the processing of the shows so that they will be processed faster, so that... then we can just, when somebody's finished uploading a show, it will get emails to the admin list, which are, again, people who are open to anybody who is known to the community. And one of those people can then simply approve or disprove the show. And we're also looking at a way to bypass that, which is why you're asked for your PGP key. So the idea is that if you've got your PGP key in there and you know you're a trusted member, there's a little tick goes beside your name. That way you can automatically validate your own shows and submit them in so there'll be nobody in the way. But the issue is right at the minute that we do get different formats of different interpretations of formats, and that's presenting us with a little bit of a problem. So basically the upload is still a manual task at the moment. That's the long and the short of it. And when we heard this show, we had a quick look to see if this would be any use to us, so that, you know, perhaps people could start submitting shows in Markdown or any of the other formats that Pandoc supports, because then it would allow us to pull out valid XHTML for slurping into the show notes. So that pretty much was that. And this was an excellent episode. Excellent introduction to Pandoc and Markdown by Be Easy.
I keep waiting for Dave to comment on this, but he must be like doing that that SQL query thing.
No, I'm not. I'm just sort of absorbing the possibilities here, because the whole issue of submitting. Well, let me go back a bit. The way I actually do my shows, and I've been doing this for a while now, is I write them in Markdown, and I use Pandoc to generate the output. And I discovered along the way that Pandoc can generate EPUB, and I've been playing around with putting EPUB out and that sort of stuff. What I had wanted to do in the days before we had the new submission form was I was producing a script or set of scripts which I was hoping I could could offer to people and say, look, run these, and they will simplify the process of you generating your show. I think it was maybe not entirely a realistic idea. It's what I do. I use the scripts to do this, but I'm not sure they're really going to ever be suitable for somebody else to use. And as an aside, the reason why I'm still producing my shows in the format that I am is because I'm using this script set, which is still generating them in the old format. And I haven't changed it yet. But this has taught me that generating Markdown is a great way to go, because it's a relatively simple way of representing text that you want to turn into HTML or various other formats. I don't think it's a very difficult one to use, personally. It's very, very close to the way I used to make ASCII notes back in the day before Markdown was even invented. And I think that's why Markdown was invented, because it is very similar to the way that people used to make notes on, you know, on PDAs and, you know, just typing on terminals and whatever. And so, you know, it seemed to me to be a pretty good way of going forward. But I find when I make utterances like this, I find very often I'm completely out of step. So I tend not to say them very often. But here's me saying it now.
Well, I wouldn't have any problem switching to Markdown. I've been using just kind of simple HTML for my notes, but I'm also very familiar with Markdown, and if you guys decided that's what we should do, that'd be super easy. I use it all the time at work, because the learning management system we use, Moodle, has built-in Markdown support, and so I'm always writing quick notes to my students using Markdown for some simple formatting. But I like to sprinkle in a bit of HTML, just because you have a little more control with that.
Yes, that's true. But well, that's an important point you've made, John, because Markdown is becoming more or less the standard across a wide range of applications. I'm not an expert on this, but I certainly see it in many contexts. I think GitHub has it, and GitLab has it, and many others do. I couldn't enumerate them all. So I think it's becoming generally accepted out there in the world.
Okay, well then, I would suggest. Personally, I don't care, so long as it's valid. If somebody uploads shownotes.md or whatever, or shownotes.html, then that will be treated as an XHTML document. If they upload shownotes.md, that will be treated as a Markdown document, or they just paste in Markdown. But which of the 4,000 variants are we going to support? And this is why...
Well, I think most of them essentially handle things the same way. I mean, I use multi-markdown on my laptop, but then the code that I use it with almost always looks exactly the same when I use it on Moodle on the learning management system, and I click save. It'll show up just like I had on my laptop. So I think the many variants of this aren't... It seems like the differences come in the more advanced kind of markup that you do, things like tables and stuff like that. The very basic things like bullet points, bold, italics, those I think are going to be pretty much the same across all of the various flavors of Markdown.
Yeah, personally, I think it's fine. If people want to send in Markdown, that's fine. If they don't send in HTML, that's fine. But what makes life difficult is when it's a mixture of the two. When it's formatted text, pre-formatted text, when it kind of looks like Markdown, but it's got some HTML in there, it means you really need to, you're better off having plain text, stopping, and what you end up doing, what I end up having to do is basically rewriting the show notes manually. And that, if that happens and it's in the queue and there are HOs behind, then the HOs behind are waiting because I don't have the time right at that moment to fix it. And so, yeah, just try and send in sane stuff to us. That would be great.
Yeah, I was. I've been looking at the possibility of analyzing text which is not any sort of markup language, or possibly maybe first of all detecting what it is, if at all possible, and if it's not anything known, flagging it and having a bit of a go at turning it into Markdown and then offering it to somebody, Ken or myself, to in an editor to fix it and then turn it, then put it through Pandoc to generate HTML. But that's not a simple thing at all. It's turning out, I think most people would have guessed, to be quite complex.
But we'll see how it goes. If Markdown using Pandoc to convert from Markdown in text HTML, which is what we put on the website, is easy peasy lemon squeezy. So great if we can do that. But if you are using some form of Markdown, can you just put in the heading that what type of Markdown you're using? If it's some sort of, I think there's probably converters from all these languages to HTML or XHTML, yeah? So that's not an issue. What I'd like to know is what people would like having supported. So that would be kind of cool, so that we would know beforehand. Because it would be easy to put in my show notes are in HTML, my show notes are in Markdown, my show notes are in formatted plain text. Also, we don't want to make it too complex for people, because the show notes, as always, are optional. If you don't, we want the shows, we'll get somebody to write the show notes, me. So, send in something, send in shows, that's important. But, okay.
The other thing I suppose we could talk about, BeEasy has done here, there are tools that assist in the process of generating Markdown. I think it's Retext is the one in the first one in his list there. I think I've used that, which lets you type Markdown in ones in a two in a double pane screen. You type it in one pane and you see the result in the other. You can run that on your desktop, and that's actually quite a useful way of preparing stuff.
And a lot of editors have plugins that will do this too. It seems like I use Genie as my main text editor, and it has a Markdown plugin that will give you a preview. Jezra also has written a Markdown preview program. I think he just calls it Markdowner, and I've got it installed on here, but I haven't used it all that much. I normally don't need the preview because I already know what it's going to look like.
Yeah, same here. I use the Vim's Pandoc plugin that knows, it checks the syntax of stuff that I write, and I just run it through a makefile and then look at it in a browser. That's the way I work, but couldn't force that on anybody else.
Yeah, but again, it doesn't actually matter, because you guys send in validated, because you work at this stuff, and as does BeEasy, so the stuff that you guys are going to be sending in is going to be valid, whatever the spec is. It's when you start kind of deviating from the spec where, you know, maybe newer users or people unfamiliar with that, we're putting in a barrier to submitting shows if you have to learn Markdown and if you have to learn HTML. So possibly another option might be to put in a WYSIWYG editor on the HPR website, which can't be done using static HTML and would need to have a, yes, JavaScript tool on the page to do that. But that could be a pop-up window that, you know, click here for more formatting that you would know that you were going into a JavaScript website, web page on the website, because there is no JavaScript on HPR. If you come across JavaScript on HPR, it's been put there maliciously. So maybe might be no harm firing an email off to the mailing list to get people discussing this.
Sounds good.
Okay, let's talk about the show notes for this excellent episode. And 0xf10e said, thanks, very useful, nice episode. Many things I didn't know about Markdown. While I prefer restructured text over Markdown, just like he or she prefers Mercurial, Python, Golang over Git, Perl, Java, I have to use it in GitLab and GitHub. So like I say, it's very useful. And the restructured text is RST2PDF works without LaTeX, smiley face. And PS, one of the words you were looking for is what you see is what you get. And John Culp is here to do his live reading of his comments.
Yeah, you're not going to like this one very much, Ken, because I point out that you can freely sprinkle in bits of HTML as needed in Markdown, and it doesn't mess up anything.
Then I do like that. I don't have a problem with... Again, I don't have a problem with stuff so long as it comes out as the author intended at the end.
Okay.
And that actually, when Dave and I were doing some tests on this, I was quite impressed to see that it allowed HTML to pass through, some HTML to pass through, not all, if I saw it correct.
Yeah, I'm not even sure which does and which doesn't, but I know it, when I'm using Moodle and I put any kind of hyperlinks, like I can't use the shortcut for Markdown hyperlinks, you know, the angle brackets on either end of the URL, I can use it. But then on our version of Moodle, at least, when I go back and try to re-edit something, my link disappears for, I have no idea why. But so when I'm putting a hyperlink in a Markdown page on Moodle, I use standard HTML A tag with the href and all of that to make my links, just because I know if I don't, I'm going to be sorry later.
Yeah, so... And this is exactly the point. So say you have Dave who does it that way, and then we process it and we don't realize that, and the person who's submitting the show doesn't realize that that's happening. And then we have to manually edit it to get all the links, because all the links are now broken. So we end up spending more time putting the links back in, fixing your HTML for you. And then the question is, do you reply back to the host saying, look, I've just wasted a half hour of my life fixing your show notes, which you, in all good faith, sent in to me, you know, which is why this is a very awkward topic for me to discuss, because I don't want to stop people from contributing, and I also don't want to necessarily give feedback about, you know, show notes not being submitted correctly, because they have been submitted. It's just it's taken me quite a long time to figure them out. But going back to your example, it is possible for us to fix that, because if that is the only issue with Markdown coming through, and if everybody's submitting shows with Markdown, not saying that anybody has to, you can still submit them with text or not, we'll do the show notes, then we can always write a pre and post parser script that will, beforehand check for that and fix it, and afterwards extract all the links and put them into a links section at the bottom, which is something that we're planning on doing anyway, because of the way that we release our show notes. Not all feed readers convert links correctly, so we always make sure that our links are visible for copying and pasting. So, for example, instead of saying click here for Hacker Public Radio, it will be click here and then in brackets http://hackerpublicradio.org.
Ah, that's good to know.
So yes, we can get around all the stuff, but it's in some ways it's been easy. Some of the things have been easy to fix or to automate because, you know, everybody's doing it that way. So then, you know, fine, we'll just do it that way. Other things about how to do your show notes is a very personal thing. So I want to make sure that whatever we put up is what the host intended us to put up. So yeah, just like that. And Dave, do you want to do a live reading of your comment?
Indeed. I said excellent episode. I use Markdown and Pandoc myself for all my HBR episode, though I've not yet moved away from ASCII doc when writing my own project notes and similar things. I did start with that a number of years ago. And a while ago, I'd been looking at the best lightweight markup format. I was very happy to find Markdown. And then I found Pandoc and very much appreciated its extensions and huge range of features. So thanks very much for your great overview. So yeah, it's really, really useful to bring this to everybody's attention.
And it's definitely going to be added to the toolbox of the show automation. So thanks very much for that. The following show was Resurrecting at IBM T40, an attempt to bring a 13-year-old laptop back to life from Swift 110, who I keep missing in the IRC channel. And the reason for that is I check in the morning on the train and then check in at the beginning of work, and I'm really not often into the IRC. I just pop in and out. So not avoiding you, Swift 110. Very good episode. I love this laptop. Always wanted one, but they were always too expensive.
Yeah, great laptop. I'd quite relish something like that myself, actually, just as the one to take to conferences or something like that.
And it's the perfect train.
Is this one of those ones? Is this one of those ones that's got that little red dot thing by your index finger to use as a mouse?
Yep.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. I've never had one of these, but I've seen them.
These are like the ones that you can, you know, assault and battery, you know, you can use them as a laptop and also a blunt instrument. But a good show. And then the following day, lowering the quality of shows again, John Culp with his password cards. How to hide a password using a password card.
That's up to somebody else to start submitting shows, so there's not enough room for me to submit anymore.
There you go. Stop him. This was excellent show. Thanks, John, for this. And I would not have used this myself, but I can see how it would be cool.
I don't use it all the time, but like I said in the episode, I use a password card to hide one of my passwords that I find myself needing to type in occasionally. Otherwise, I just use the password databases on KeePass on my phone, my tablet, and my laptop.
Yeah, I use a... oddly enough, I like this because you could print off this and give it to somebody and say, look, you know, here's your password there, from there to there, and then they'll have it and it's printed on their screen. And I like it as maybe the entry to your KeePass stuff that's on your monitor.
Yeah, well, it's certainly better than just taping the password in plain text under your keyboard or something.
Well, you know, about that, I think that if you're at home, that's a valid thing to do. It's not a great thing to do security-wise. It's not something that I would ever encourage people to do. But, you know, if somebody's breaking into your home, they're physically got access to your home computer. I think all bets are off at that stage, you know?
Yeah, well, there's that, yeah.
And, okay, cool. And comments, Dave, do you want to read your comment?
Yes. I certainly found the show very useful and said so. I'd never come across this idea before, and thought it was really good. Didn't know about PWGen, actually. I've got out of the world of password generators, really, these days. I use KeePass for everything. Back in the day when I was working at university, I used to use APG as a password generator, which was the rage at the time. But it was the days when we all thought that 8-character passwords were highly secure. So... Oh, and thank you very much for the ambient bird song at the start of the episode, I said, which, as always, I really enjoy sort of out there in the world type things.
The outside in the world ones, yeah, I do like.
Yeah, I have a couple more of those kinds of things coming up as well. Yeah, PWGen is something I use also with one of the scripts that I use to make my cat post the, I think I call it Security Kitty's password of the day. And so he'll post a message to the social networking timeline with a randomly generated password of a specified character length. And it uses PWGen to create the password.
That's very good. I actually wrote my own password generator years ago because I wrote the university's student registration system, so the students came in and got their accounts when they started at the university and that sort of stuff. If they lost the passwords, it generated them a new one on a bit of paper and that type of thing. So I wrote that, and I feel completely dwarfed by how wonderful these things are compared to the crappy thing that I produced.
I got to brag on my son here. My son took a computer programming class over the summer, and he did it online through Duke University, and it was for kids about his age. He's 14, and it was for kids, I think, between 12 and 15 years old, and they learned C#. That's not necessarily the language I would have chosen, but he seemed to learn quite a bit, and then after the class was over, he had an idea one day to write his own random password generator, and he did it. It took him maybe half an hour, and he came up with a random password generator that uses the random library in C#, and it takes as the character set all of the valid ASCII characters, and you can tell it how many characters you want the password to be, and it'll generate one for you. So I was really proud of him. He did a nice job on that.
Very cool. Yeah, yeah. That sounds like the sort of stuff that we were doing back in the day. We had other constraints as well because people confused ones and L's, so you had to filter out any potential ambiguity and other potential ambiguities in the things. And we were also generating passwords for a whole range of different services, some of which had really crappy Windows password limits and some of which had less crappy limits. And so the thing had to know, this is the password for system X, therefore it needs to be made in this way and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But yes, it's a fun subject, but I'm glad I don't do it anymore, to be honest.
Yeah. By the way, I think the PWGen program has command line options that will take care of the kinds of difficulties you describe. I mean, you can leave out special characters or include them, or you can leave out numbers or include them, and you can also tell it to avoid characters that could be mistaken for other characters, like zero and uppercase O.
I saw that. That's why I was saying I was sort of shocked at how clever it was compared to my crappy efforts at this back in the day.
Well, still, you had the fun of writing one.
Yeah.
So the following day was a Friday. I noticed because it was LibreOffice Impress Pictures using and formatting pictures, creating a photo album. And this is part of Ahuka's LibreOffice and LibreOffice series, and he's now on LibreOffice Impress. And I did not know that this was possible, that you could even scan directly from a scanner into a photo album. This actually might be quite useful for some other project that I was thinking about, scanning old documents for archiving. So very, very good show there.
As usual. I mean, once again, I use this program quite a lot for my slideshows where I teach at the university. And yet again, he comes up with something that I'd never even heard of that it can do. So Ahuka always manages to do that.
And again, he's doing nothing more than reading the man page. Although, in fairness, it's Ahuka, and he's writing it as he goes along as well. He does contribute back to this project quite a lot. So well done, him.
Yep.
Then we had the status net shuffle, and this is through and NY Bill talking about status.net instance and converting it to GNU Social. And I can't say anything bad about through for several reasons. One, that he has a video of me at Odd Camp that hopefully he will never release on the internet. So
I have seen it, Ken, but I know it exists anyway.
Yes, very embarrassing.
Dave, can you send that to me, please?
okay, sure, yeah.
And but interesting, a lot of work involved in this GNU Social. A lot more. I'm so glad that I'm not actually managing a GNU Social website, to be honest.
No, this, yeah, I jumped on Windigos about a year or two ago.
Yeah, I hadn't fully appreciated all the ins and outs of these things. It's having joined GNU Social in the past, well, since FOSDEM, actually, it understand a little bit more about what running such a thing must be, though I don't particularly want to do it. It's quite impressive.
I ran one for quite a while, but then there was a database crash on my server, I decided I didn't want to anymore. And so I just got myself an account on Windigo's instance of GNU Social. And I'm much happier that way.
Yeah, it is. You get a lot more sleep at night.
Yep.
And there were comments to that episode by X0XF10E. You should put up some VPS-based blog, something where you could push Markdown or RST to a Git or Mercurial repository. This is way harder to lose the contents as you have it in at least two different places. To which my Bill replied, maybe someday. I never thought of that. Even if it's not a published blog, at least you can keep your notes safe. This is a method. This method would make for a good HBR episode. Wink, wink. No pressure. See, I'm turning everybody into a you need to submit shows person. And then we had a German gentleman, to be frank, who we met as Dave Belgium.
FOSDEM.
Thank you. That's the one.
FOSDEM.
Sorry, falling asleep. It's past my bedtime. And he put an SSD into his Linux box and supplied all the commands to do that. I have just been given a SSD, 250 gig SSD laptop with 16 gigs of RAM. And I put Fedora 22 on it from work. And now I'm taking it off because it doesn't support ISO 8601 dates Fedora 22. Annoying, but there you go. But yes, I'm very happy about that. That made my day. But I still haven't had a chance to use
it. Sounds like a nice machine.
Yep, it's a nice Dell, quite a lot lighter than the one that I have at the minute. But I had thought it was a smaller model, which would have been nice for the train and stuff, you know, to have a beefy laptop. But yeah, I do a lot of processing, offline processing of large database C type files. So, yes, that was a good show, and tips about trim support, which I had no idea existed, but there you go. And 0XF10E, who I think at this stage, if you comment three times, that you have to actually do a show. A little correction on ATA trim. Fragmentation of files isn't a problem on SSD, but the SSD controller needs to know which blocks can be used for leveling out the wear of the flash cells, as the SSD knows nothing about the file system it's storing the data on, only can swap out the blocks when they're overwritten once. Unless, of course, the OS tells the solid-state drive, I need free these logical blocks, you do not want to use them. This is why the SSD controller can add the blocks to its free list and reallocate the underlying flash cells as soon as all the logical blocks are freed, or remap the leftover logical blocks to the free the rest of the flash cell. Oops, got a little long. Don't worry about that. And Nora replied, Dave, do you want to do that or not?
Fine. Sorry. Distracted there for a second. Yeah, Noah says minimizing writes. I just want to take a quick moment to disagree with your recommendation to put swap and or /var on a traditional spinning disk in order to limit writes to your SSD. Yes, doing so may ultimately increase the expected lifetime of the drive, but you're missing out on the greatest benefits of the SSD by doing so. SSDs are extremely fast for random access patterns, but for sequential operations such as reading or writing large files, they aren't significantly faster than spinning disks. The parts of your system that perform the most random access operations are likely to be swap and /var. speeding up swap is quite possibly the single best application for an SSD in a Linux system. And that's which is interesting. Yeah, yeah. I've heard more people saying the opposite, I have to say, but I don't know the truth of it myself.
But that sounds like a logical argument, actually.
It does, yes.
Cool. But yes, Noah and 0xf10e, if nothing else, do a show explaining how to pronounce your handle. That would be awesome. Thank you very much. Both of you guys could do little shows about those. That'd be fantastic. And thanks again, Frank, for sharing that episode. And if anyone has any little smidgen of German at all, their show, Linux Under Angst, is absolutely awesome. Lovely podcast to listen to. It's very slow, and it's got lots of words in there that even if you have no clue of German, you'll be able to kind of pick up what they're talking about. Waking up Windigo, and we've learned in the intervening time that his headdress is not special Indian headdress. He's looking through a pinball machine, apparently, in his thing, which is a lot less a lot less cool than I thought it was going to be. So yes,
it's quite cool if it's in its own way, though. It's just to support Windigo there. It's quite cool.
It is cool. And I saw this or something similar to it at the Dutch camp thing that I went to and reported from, and was very hot, and I can't remember its name.
That was Ohm, wasn't it?
Thank you very much, Dave, my resident Heimrey.
Have to do the same for me sometime.
Yep, Ohm 2015, I think, or 2013 or something.
13, I think it was.
Yep. And he has a Dell Mini 9, and there are many ways to approach a problem. And I can be happily say that I would not have picked any of his ways of approaching this problem. So essentially,
this episode was just awesome. Really,
it is awesome. Don't get me wrong; it's awesome. It's just how other people approach the same problem. I would have just gone, "Well, there's only one way to do that, and it's this." I would never have thought of putting Audacious to sleep for 5 seconds and then waking it up again. Which is a perfectly valid way of doing it. Don't get me wrong.
I don't think I would have done it that way. I mean, I have a comment to this episode that will summarize my thoughts on it, but yeah.
Shall we jump down to that? Yeah, go ahead.
After hearing this episode, my comment has the title, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Sorry about that. I've been having a little bit of audio breakup on my end, but I'm assuming that it's going okay on y'all's end.
Yeah.
So the title of my comment is The Very Essence. And I say, Windigo, I salute you. In this episode, you've captured the spirit, the very essence of HPR. Either that, or you were just trying to see if you could make Dave Morris twitch enough to send shockwaves across the ocean and feel them over here. All of us listening, I'm sure, were shouting suggestions at our audio players, but every last one of them would have drained the awesome out of your alarm system. I see no bugs here.
Absolutely perfect. Absolutely perfect. And Dave, to which you replied,
"Yeah, that was a great comment there, John. Yes, I said, well, of course, I had to then say, well, I wouldn't have done it that way, but no, that was just a joke. A fine, entertaining show, sir. Well, I wouldn't have done it though, but that was I wasn't really here to chastise and wag a finger at him, but that was really the point. But no, I wouldn't have done it that way." Probably would have bought an alarm clock, actually, but that breaks through the whole hacker spirit. I didn't twitch excessively. I wasn't wild about the multiple sleep solution, but then neither were you, I said in my comment. I thought the use of at was great. Back around 2005, I wrote a thing for my work as a sysadmin at a university that allowed people to request migration of their mailboxes from a Unix mail system to Exchange by sending an email to a particular server. It slurped their mail out of one system and into the other one, the Exchange system, using IMAP. But I didn't want there to be more than about four slurp jobs running one, because IMAP is not very efficient. So anyway, long story short, I used at to schedule the work and to avoid bottlenecks. And this was a Supreme Lashup. They're not quite in the same ballpark as Windigo's one, I think. Supreme Lashup, but it worked. Yours is the perfect hacker story. Thanks.
And NY Bill replied, I think the next logical step here is to enter your desired wake-up time from the Mini 9 via clockwork.
Steampunk.
Oh, awesome. And Bezra replied, this episode shows exactly why non-geeks think geeks are weird, while giving us geeks a nice warm glow. Yes, you could buy an alarm clock for pennies, but where would the fun and sense of achievement be in that? I once found myself in a hotel room without my phone or any other kind of alarm. I had to be up early for the next meeting. My solution was to create a simple MS Access application. He was on the company laptop, to pull the system clock until it reached 5:30, then repeatedly triggered the beep. I took all of 5 minutes to code and test. Absolutely excellent.
That's pretty good, that, yes.
That's great. I would love to see this become a series, guys. Like, Dave, you know those clock, you know those, is it Gutenberg machines, or, you know, that hits a hammer that falls thing? And, oh, what do you call them?
Yes, yes.
This reminds me of I saw it the other day in sorry, Dave, go ahead.
No, sorry. I was just trying to think of an answer to to help Ken's memory there.
Goldberg machine, that's the one.
Yeah, Rube Goldberg is what you were thinking, wasn't it? Yes, yes. Sorry, John.
Now, I was just going to say that the other day I had to go to a meeting on campus in the computer science building. And in the men's room inside the bathroom stall, there was a poster on the inside of the stall that clearly was made by one of the computer science graduate students or someone. And it said, months of programming can save you weeks of planning.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's what this reminds me of.
Absolutely. No, when the script does exactly what it says on the tin. Have a script that will wake you up in the morning. Does it wake you up? Yes or no? Then we had John Culp the following day with my new used pickup truck. And I have to admit, for quite a while through this, I was going, does this pass the of interest to hacker test? Or was it John just telling us all how cool his new pickup truck was? Right until the moment where you said about the making a copy of your keys, if you have two keys, that you can clone it. From then on, it was hacking all the way as far as I was concerned.
Well, I tried to mix in some do-it-yourself repairs and stuff like that. But the ability to clone the keys using doing it yourself inside the truck rather than paying either a locksmith or the Ford dealership, much more money to do it. To me, I like that.
Absolutely. I didn't even know it was possible, because my brother got charged €300 for that, which was more than the price of a secondhand car he bought.
I don't know that that would have cost this much. I don't know if that would have cost this much for the truck, for the truck key, but I think it would have been about $80 or $90, and I paid $15.
I actually like this episode, because the whole way through, used to do a lot of repairs on my car, you know, back when I had a car, and I just was basically able to afford every pay packet was putting something else on to make it not fall apart as much. So these were enjoyable shows. So keep it coming, yeah?
Yeah, I have part of an episode about the brake repair job already recorded, but now I have to actually do the brake repair job, and I'll do some recording after that.
Cool. Excellent. Dave, you have to say?
No, I was just agreeing with the appeal of the key cloning bit. I've certainly hacked the key on my previous car, which was not as sophisticated, but the electronics of it all fell out, and so I've sort of rebuilt it in an alternative shell. I think I managed to acquire an empty one from the car dealer, because if you know, it's all massive amounts of expense if you want new keys and stuff. It's one of these rip-offs.
Gotcha. So.
Like toner on printers and stuff.
Indeed.
Anyway.
The following day, we had running an external command on Kate, and I must admit, you know, HBR talking about is this show of interest to hackers. For new listeners, if you're wondering if your show is of interest to hackers or not, it is if one or more hackers are interested in it. So you're already a hacker because you're submitting a show to Hacker Public Radio. So you only need one other person to be interested in the show for it to be of interest to hackers. And that other person usually is me. And in this case, I cheated a little because I was the person recording the show and the person listening to the show. This was just for me because every so often after a update, this plugin to Kate disappears and it takes me an hour or two to figure out how to get it back. So I thought, well, I'll do a HPR show because we were running all very, very, very low on shows at the time. On how to get it back. So I don't know if it's of interest to anybody. I hope it was, but it definitely will be for me in the future.
Yeah, that I thought is really interesting. You know, I've never taken to KDE. I've tried it a few times, and the one part of it that I really liked was the Kate text editor, but I didn't like the rest of it enough to keep it. So and I really liked hearing this. I do similar things to this with Blather voice commands, but it would be pretty cool to have this text filter thing set up in my Genie text editor. But I don't think there's a plugin that does this exact thing for Genie.
Now, Kate is pretty smart editor. It's not quite as nice as Vim, but but it's appealing to a different audience, I think. And I certainly use it. I use Kate quite a lot, and I thought this was very helpful and interesting. I've not really explored all the ins and outs of Kate, so it's good to know about this.
Yeah, I end up just doing Kate the whole day because it's just my editor of choice. I don't know how it happened, but it happened. And this plugin, one day when I twigged I could do this, rather than having to like save the file and then do the setoc and grep and then come back in, press F5 to refresh it. This is just absolutely excellent. Even on you want to sort a table or something in the middle of a block of text, you just highlight that block of text and then you sort it. So pretty cool. Anyway, if nothing else, it was for me. And my way to Linux, how I found Linux from punch cards to Manjaro by Folky. And I have to admit that I was thrilled to get this one. Because for ages we have said that if people, contributors, feel uncomfortable about recording their shows, that they could always do a text-to-speech on it, or there's a list of people who have volunteered to do a narration of their episodes if they wished. I would love to hear Folky doing this in his own voice, but I really, really, really enjoy this episode. Not only because, like, oh, the coolness of the text-to-speech, but the fact that, as Windigo says, and I quote here, I am always a fan of how I found Linux episodes, but not many have taken me to Eastern Berlin first. A fascinating story, and hopefully the first of many episodes. Welcome to HBR. To which Folky replied, thank you very much. You're very welcome, Windigo. But I wasn't living, it wasn't Berlin. I lived in a small town not far from the Baltic Sea. I have already ideas for more episodes, and we will see when I have time to dare to record my own voice. Please do so. Yes, indeedy.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't really mind hearing eSpeak, but I would prefer to hear people's own voices. I think at first people don't like hearing themselves and they assume that other people won't like their voices, but I don't think that's true, really. It can be awkward to hear your own voice at first, but I think other people just, they don't mind. I mean, it just sounds like you. So I definitely encourage him to use his own voice here.
I think his issue is probably that English is a second language here, so we are very forgiving here. People put up with my bad English. So, yes, take your time, read it slowly, and don't worry about it. You can always put the text, if you're reading from the text, you can put the text into the show notes and people can read along. Yeah, so very good episode. Keep them coming. Thank you very much.
I was going to say the same thing. Put the text up and then we'd love to hear your voice. And what I love listening to accents as well, so go for it.
The following day, in response to our low shows, And if somebody from whose English isn't their first language can submit a show, then surely the people listening to the show who have not submitted a show in the last 12 months need to start submitting shows. Because, folks, we are running out of shows constantly. There's always a trickle, and we're relying on Dave Morris, we're relying on John Culp, we're relying on NY Bill, we're relying on Kevin Ahuka, we're relying on the old regular show people. Actually, do I have the list of people who have submitted shows? Over and over again, these people are having to submit shows because you're not getting off your lazy beep to record a show for us, yeah? So please record shows and send them in. I know you have a list of, oh, I will do that show sometime. Yeah, now is the time to start sending them in. Record them over the winter in the Northern Hemisphere. If you're in the Southern Hemisphere, well, enjoy your summer and record some shows. I don't know where that came from. Sorry, folks.
It's a rant. Yeah, you know, I actually really enjoy doing the shows, and it's not that I have to, but since the fall semester started up, I'm not going to be able to supply as many as I have over the summer. So yeah, some new people or some old people who haven't done it in a while should probably get after it here.
And that's it exactly. It's not that we don't want to hear you, John. It's just HPR, the whole point of HPR is that it is not a show where, you know, regular hosts and you got the regular slots doing the regular thing. Yes, it could be like that, but and there are people who come in quite often and will do shows. A while ago, Klaatu was doing shows quite often because he was the one who was taking up the slack. Now it's other people are coming in. Thankfully, we have more people who are coming in taking off the slack, so you don't notice as much. But I did a calculation on the number of episodes submitted by hosts. And of all the hosts last year, we had, of all the people who submitted the shows, they each had done 5 shows in the last year. Yeah, so that means that taking out the people who only submitted 1 shows, it averaged out that everybody had submitted 5 shows. So that is far, far too high. We want to have new blood coming in. We want to have people who are we want young people, old people, people from diverse communities. We want all the hackers that we can get telling us about how they got into tech, what their passion is in life. You're listening to podcasts. The excuse, oh, I have nothing interesting to say, doesn't cut it anymore. I want to know what else is on your podcast player. If you stuck for episodes, I will find you episodes. This is a community podcast, right? It's like if you're going to a lug meeting and the same 3 people are getting up every time to give you the shows. What about the other 50 people who are in the room? There are more than 8,000 people who will listen to the show. And yet we only have, I don't know, 300 people, 300 hosts who have ever contributed to a show. Guys, Dave, can you cut me off here? Because I'm going on a rant too much.
I think you've made the point there, Ken. Yes, yes.
Thank you. Speaking of people who contribute shows, it's Tish Radio 20. You've been pwned, probably. Peter64 went on holidays. I think he went to China or somewhere. And 5150 put up a show here. This has made me chuckle. It also made me very sad about that FCC ruling about the open WRT being banned on firmwares. Not very good.
That's a pity. All of the routers in my house run that stuff, so I hope I'm not running afoul of the law already. Maybe it's only in newer ones or something that this is banned. But I don't know.
They're not allowed to import them anymore, so yeah. Not good, not good. The following day, we had some bash tips by Dave.
Hold on, Ken.
Oh, sorry.
There's some comments. Do you want to go through those?
Please do.
So we had a comment from 0xf10e, who comments on the car malware issue. I'm expecting more ransomware bricking cars than causing accidents. This was in relation to the ability to hack cars. First week, windscreen wipers and air conditioning are disabled until you pay 5 bitcoins. Second week, speed is limited to 30 miles an hour until you pay 10 bitcoins. Third week, your car won't start until you pay 20 bitcoins. Way less incentive for law enforcement to come after them when they go for people's money instead of everyone's safety.
I would have actually laughed at that if it wasn't for the fact that people are encrypting hard drives and doing this very thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I know. It's a It sounds all too likely, doesn't it? And Mike Ray made the comment, "We're doomed, I tell 'ee," which I thought was rather funny.
That was essentially my thought when I was listening to this. I had to stop listening because I couldn't take any more bad news.
No, it came very thick and fast. And Mike says, "I think I'll just make myself a tinfoil hat and sit in the cupboard under the stairs. Just wait till they start cracking train and bus systems."
Actually, yeah, that I wouldn't have that much of a problem with. As I hate the public transport system, the check-in, check-out system. Maybe I'll do an episode on that too sometime. Okay, some Bash tips, Dave. Can we do that now?
Yes, indeed.
Some fantastic comments on that show. About Push-T, Pop-T, and Durs. And again, excellent show notes associated with that if you follow the link with examples. I still don't get it, Dave. You have not convinced me, unlike all your other shows. I'm not convinced by this one.
Yes, well, there was this fellow called Ken Fallon who commented to that effect. Obsolete, he says. "Hi, Dave. I can never get my head around these commands, and your show has clarified them for me. I've never been able to get a use case for this. It cannot be done using CD minus. That jumps you back to the previous directory. Running it again brings you back to where you started," which, of course, is quite true. I attempted to give one possible use case for it, but I have to say that I use this a lot, but I used it back in the day when I was a Unix system administrator, where we used dumb terminals most of the time, or we had an Xterm emulator on a Windows box or something to get to our machines. And if you just got the one terminal, then using Push-T and Pop-T is quite useful to allow you to leap around between different directories. Nowadays, it's not really necessary in most cases. So I tend to agree, but I thought it might be interesting.
I really am glad that you did this episode, because I've known about these commands, but I've never really used them. And I might try to incorporate them into some of my blather commands. So if I'm hopping around to different directories, I actually have blather commands that will take me to some of the most frequently used ones from a sysadmin's point of view. But I'd like to be able to have a series of commands to like build a stack of directories and then hop back to the second one or the fourth one or whatever. So I might experiment with this a bit.
Well, I have actually written some scripts around the idea, because there is a bash array that holds the stack, and which you can see. You can't manipulate to any great degree. You can read it, but you can't change it to have the sort of effects that you want, if I remember right. But it's a while since I looked at this. But it certainly you could write stuff around it that was able to tell you what is directory 2 in the stack or something, and then go there if you wanted to. So yeah, go for it.
But are you able to like pick from a list? If it's an array, then you should be able to pick like 0, 1, 2, and 3, store them at those locations.
You use index numbers, right?
Yeah. Okay, that might actually be useful.
Yeah, I think there are still some uses for it. As I said in my response to your comment, that it may be obsolescent or outmoded, but it's still, I think it's still worth knowing about and maybe using, as John said.
Because I always find it a bit dangerous, to be honest, when I've looked at it in the past, because if you get the ordering wrong, then suddenly you're changing into the incorrect directory, and the chances of running something. That's why I always use full paths names, not relative paths, in any script that I do, because I want to be absolutely sure I'm in that directory and no other directory.
That's good practice anyway. Yeah, I would definitely do that.
But you never know. Maybe somebody might write an alarm clock based on it. Who knows? Oh, dear.
That sounds like a challenge,
fair.
That, Ken.
That's not fair, yeah. Yeah, I'll tell you, if I do, I will do a show on it. And the following day we had the Marn. How do you pronounce that, John? Maran.
Sorry, I think it's Marantz.
Okay, thank you. And it's not a nice story how you managed to get it, but it seems like you're mother-in-law had quite an active, fulfilling life, by the sounds of it.
Certainly did, yeah. She traveled all around the world for a good part of her life, and so that was like for her work. But then she also would do field recordings. She has a book that she wrote called Voices of Resistance, which is a series of interviews with women who were involved in the Moroccan resistance back in, I don't know, the 50s or 60s or something. And so she would take this recorder and record the interviews and then transcribe them and publish them. And so, yeah, she did a lot of oral history. And I was really glad to get the recorder, but I will definitely miss her. But as I said, when she had her stroke, she was in Morocco giving a paper at a conference, doing what she loved. So she never had to give up her walk-up apartment in Manhattan and things like that. So I think she led a good life.
And so actually sounded quite nice, the recording. Better with the second microphone, I think.
Right. At first, I recorded part of it in my carport using the built-in microphones, which aren't bad, but the microphone that she had with it, the external microphone, is really a very nice one. Audio-Technica ATM710 cardioid condenser mic. And yeah, that one sounded really good.
Mike Ray replied saying, quality. I love this show, as I do all of John's shows. The words, this is John Cope in Lafayette, Louisiana, is always a guarantee of quality. Today might be an exception. Editor's note due to me being on the show. But anyway, the sound recorder sounds like a very nice piece of kit, and the sound quality was superb. Pity about the compact flash media, and the harpsichord music break was always very pleasant, to which John replied.
Thank you so much for the nice comments, Mike, regarding the bumper music. I got it from the Open Goldberg Variations, a wonderful performance and completely free to download and share. And by the way, Mike, it was not harpsichord playing it. It was a piano. However, the piece was originally written for the harpsichord.
Kevin O'Brien commented, I agree with Mike. I also find John Cope's show is very good. So that's very nice.
Thanks, Kevin.
Excellent, John. Cool. The following day, LibreOffice Impress, the theme, the gallery and themes. what I liked about this was his reference to the icons being like clip art out of the 1990s website. So, yes, very true. But I suppose that's where the history of this, people wanted clip art at one stage in their word processor.
Can't remember the last time I used clip art.
No, it tends to look a little bit cheesy, yeah, when you do, doesn't it? Because it's that type of stuff. But
yeah,
good to know.
A few magazines that I get, and homemade magazines, and they're spluttered with that sort of clip art. But doesn't take away from the content, though. It's quite nice. It's nice to know that LibreOffice has it, and why take it out?
And you can put your own in as well, which I actually sat down there following along with Impress for this one, just so I could get to the full details of it. And it's a hell of a thing, hell of a package that LibreOffice is.
And then the next day we had did a quick review of his favorite multimeter, the Unity UT601E. I liked this as well, also because I'm following up watching the other multimeter videos on YouTube, and this one looks like it's covered all the bases with regards to things that he suggests. I also see that he's got a variable power supply on his desk. Photograph is supplied. So I like these. I think MI Bill is assuming that people listening know more about stuff than we do. So a few basic,
probably.
Yeah, a few basic shows on stuff will be really helpful. That'd be cool.
I agree. I would definitely like to hear more about basically how to use this thing, rather than a product review.
Mike Ray said the UT meters. He had a great episode on the UT multimeters. He had a UT60A, which has an opto-isolated serial port. Sadly, the software was totally inaccessible to someone who, like himself, can't see. So he's been writing his own to run on Linux, and those of us who know about Mike Ray will understand that this is what he does. Admittedly, I started a few years ago and did some initial work on reverse engineering the protocol, which I can't find documented anywhere. Hearing this episode is always prodded, I was prodded to resurrect the code and compiling it. I have another multimeter which actually talks, which has stopped me doing the completing project once before. I think the UT60E, possibly other models like the UT61E, have similar ports and probably have serial also. It's always impressive range of meters given the price, by editor's note or my note. It seems to correspond with what I've seen on other videos. Anyway, back to Mike's comments. When I have something completed and talking, I'll stick it on the web and do a show. Yes, you will. Thank you. It could be good to get Blather to respond by making measurements and reading it out aloud. God, that would be awesome.
Great. Yeah.
It'd be worth then, because this is like a reasonably affordable multimeter, because then you'd know it'll work in Linux. It works with Blather.
Mm-hmm.
And all the shows that Mike and MI Bill would, we could follow along, everybody using the same multimeter.
So NY Bill commented, replied to this comment saying, thanks for the kind words, Mike. Sorry, you can hear my cat in the background, maybe? I don't know. That's
yes.
Just an
I thought it was somebody cleaning
this microphone I've got is so sensitive that you can probably hear a gnat fart from really some distance away. Anyway, that's just an episode. And that I felt like doing because I felt I was a bit harsh on the UniT meters. You do get a lot of bang for your buck with those units. And yes, this one has the serial to optocouple connector as well. Who has... Sorry.
What's your cat called, Dave?
Misty. She's
hitting a punching bag or something.
she's annoyed because she can't go out because I can't get up and open the door and let her out. We don't have a cat flap, she's sort of expressing herself. How far had I got? Yes, I did say they sell a connector that will go to USB. But as I said in the episode, I don't really feel a need for that feature anyway. However, I'm sure some do. And yes, if you could get one of these meters going text-to-speech, that's an episode I'd like to hear.
Me too. Dave, you can go and let the cat out. Never thought I'd say that.
right.
The reason for the USB stuff is I think you can do logging to over time. So you could log... voltage or current over time, and if you had two of them, you could log voltage and current and then calculate the power of stuff as it recharges overnight. Copying all this,
that'd be cool,
from the guy who uses it for he does that logging to computer with the multimeters so that he can see how much power consumption he's getting from his solar panels. Anyway, Mike Ray replied, the unit T-meters and serial ports. Having written the first comment, I took another look online and found some stuff about the standard DMM chip used inside the meter and I think all the Unity meters. The only problem I think might be the serial port. I'm not yet sure whether it will work with an either PL2303 or a FTDI USB to serial adapter, since the client software needed to raise either a CTS or an RTS or both to power the octocoupler in the leads. If UT sell a USB to meter adapter, I'd like to know where to get one. I particularly like the RMS feature you mentioned in your show, which is uncommon in such a cheap meter. And the RMS is where it takes an average of the voltage AC current and... Back to the comment. I'm jealous of your ability to add a timeout power modifier, though. Could have done with that when I could see, but not now. Forever leave my meter switched on and flattening the batteries. To which NY Bill replied, here's the USB connector, Mike. This says it will work with a UT61, and I see a UT60 is listed. I think they're going to use that question mark like an asterisk. It's cheap enough. maybe I'll throw one in the cart for the next Amazon order and see if I can get the UTF unit software working with Wine. Slash me wonders if Ken or Dave is reading all this in the community news. Let's be verbose. Ha ha ha, MIville. Yes, we are.
Nice.
Yes, nice. I didn't even spot that earlier on. So, Mike Ray replied, PL2303 USB 2RS232 and UT6. Thank you, Mike. I'm happy to report that my software works with the meter plugged into a PL2303 USB to serial adapter. So either the octocouplers are being powered somehow else, or I have the term IO set up right. Or there is some magic about the adapter. I don't think these things supported hardware. I didn't think these things supported hardware handshaking pins. And you two guys need to have a room to continue talking about these comments. Thank you very much.
You do realize that we shouldn't even have read these according to the rules, because they're September's comments, not August's. But I'll shut up now and go away.
No, I thought we were allowed to read them if they were in the show.
Yeah.
So this show was
I was just being facetious.
Thank you, Dave. I did mention it's late, and I've been working hard all day. Thank you very much. Okay, 30
hey guys,
comments.
Guys, I'm going to have to take off. I'm going to take my kids to their pottery class, but I've enjoyed it, and I'll talk to you all later.
John, thank you very much for joining.
Thanks.
We're going to wrap up. It's going on too long.
See you soon, bye. John. Cheers.
God, I thought that guy would never leave. Sheesh.
I'm still here.
Oh, John, yes, enjoy your day.
Bye, guys.
See you, John. Nice guy. I actually looked up where Lafayette, Louisiana is. Close to
yes.
New Orleans. It's
yes.
only that far on the map.
It's this is why John's often mentioned going to sit by the swamps and that sort of stuff. Sounds good.
I seriously, you know, I have it in my head like do 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 that I will someday take the kids. Not that they ever wanted to go to Disneyland or anything, but take the kids and drive around. You know, hire a Winnebago and go around the states and meet up with all the podcasters as I go. I'd love to do that, because some of the places where, you know, people live are really, really, really beautiful places.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I sympathize with that point of view.
Okay, David, how are we doing with the comments?
Well, we have two that are not included in the in the way we've just read them. Hold on a second.
That's the will in my bill. Sorry I'm late. So don't forget your reverbs. Which was in my bill talking about refurbishing his Lenovo and modifying it to the way he likes it. This is where he did the put the speakers in the front and changed the BIOS. And his comment was, sorry I'm late, on the comments, guys, I bought the rig via Micro Center Pokey. So this is a comment on a question that Pokey had. Again, in case you didn't answer, beyond repair, So yes, you probably bought something by now, but just in case anyone reads it in the future, Newegg, Tiger Direct, Lenovo Outfits, and the Dell Outlet also sell refurbs. And thanks for the kind words, Charles and AJ. Yes, I've always hacking on something, and it's fun to blab about projects on HPR as well. Yes, it is. And this is me checking comments. It's only been about 9 months. Fair enough.
I did point out to NY Bill that he could subscribe to the comment feed and get them in a more timely way. I'm not sure that people are fully aware of its existence, to be honest.
I actually want to talk about that as well. Just remind me in a minute. There was another show comment on LastPass getting hacked. What does it mean? Which was won by Ahuka, who put it into perspective for us. And AMP made the valid point, but it is not free software. Free isn't freedom. Would not be unethical? Question mark. And again, to remind everybody, we're here. HPR itself is not necessarily a free software show. You could do shows on proprietary software if you wished. The fact that most people who are on support free software is a by-the-by. But yes, he does have a point, Amp. And that is why I use, not KeePass, but let me see, I'll just look over my wife's computer while Dave reads the next comment.
There aren't any more comments again. Well, that's it. That was the last one.
KeePassX, K-E-E-P-A-S-S-X, is an equivalent piece of software that is completely open and you can use that. So there you go. That's another piece of news. What do we have in the show notes, Dave?
We have three emails to look at, and that's it really.
Do you want to go through?
Yep. Well, the first one was on the 15th of August. Was me saying help with tags and summaries, asking people if they would be prepared to join in with the process of adding tags and summaries to shows. And I'd created a script which summarizes all of the missing tags and summaries, all the shows that need them. And there's a web page that's mentioned in this message. And there's a web, an email address, I mean, to which you can send updates. And the email described the format that we needed in the email message. It's very simple. It's just a tag show and the show number, summary colon, and the summary and tags colon followed by a list of tags. You just send that, and there's software which can check it and put it into the database. So that would be great, but I don't think anybody's had a chance to do that yet.
Yeah, as people want to contribute to this, just to give us a little bit, give us a shout, tags at hackerpublicradio.org. And as I don't know, maybe we could set up a feed or something, a way that you could every day get another show that we need shows for, perhaps. Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
It would be nice if people could, if you want to listen to shows, you could download today's episode of HPR and an archive, one from the archive, and listen to those and send us in show notes. That would be fantastic. And Kevin O'Brien sent a mail to the say about John Culp wanting to contribute to the LibreOffice show, and he says that's absolutely fine, and anybody who wishes to do that can. And John replied, of course, saying that he's done, thanking him for that, and that he's also done some shows in the privacy and security series.
And the last email was one that you sent, Ken, which was entitled "Do You Owe Me a Show?" Where you pointed out that we're running short of shows and making a request for contributions, which I think must have had a certain amount of response, but could certainly do with a lot more, I think.
Yeah, exactly, and I think I've already ranted long enough about that, but on the HPR website, if you go to the calendar page, you'll see that we track the number of shows and stuff in the list. But there's also a few things that I personally track to know if the health of HPR is, how the health of HPR itself is going. So we've got the next free slot, which is the red line, and that's kind of the one people tend to watch quite a lot, and that jumps around a lot because we leave certain, a host who's contributing a lot tends to leave spaces for other people to come in. So when the slots get filled, it jumps from, one day to the next free slot to 20 days or something like that. And then the shows in the queue is one that I don't particularly pay that much attention to. So we quite often have quite a lot of shows in, but we still have gaps in the queue. So you see quite a bit of difference. But the one that tells me about the health of HBR as a project is the number of hosts we have that in the queue. And from its peak, we've had 20 people in the queue down, and that goes down quite a lot. It's gone down to under 3 at one stage earlier on this year. And it's between 10 and 5 mostly. And that's not good. We need to get that up. That should be up at around 100 people in the queue, you know?
Yeah. I tend to look at the red one, and now you point out the green line. It's a little worrying, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's you know, people contribute. You have regulars who come in and contribute quite a lot, but eventually, you know, life catches up with all of us, and we're lucky now that there are several people that are regularly contributing shows, so nobody's noticing it that much, but it's 5 or 10 people that are contributing shows. That's why I love to see people coming in with new shows, old-time hosts returning, doing their one slot a year. That's exactly what we want, because we've, to be honest, if everybody decided in the morning, everybody who's listening to this decided, okay, I'm going to do my show and shut this guy up and submitted the shows, you know, we would have 4 or 5 years of shows in the queue, and you know, we'd be spoiled for riches. But the fact of the matter is, it's a very, very tiny percentage of people keeping this project alive. So we don't ask for contributions, although in fairness, if you wanted a good deal on hosting, go to anhonesthost.com. See what I did there, Dave? See what I did there?
Well done.
Okay, so, but let's skip over that. I've bored people to death about that. There was one other thing. There's something up with my email or the email on the server, which John is looking at. Not John.
Josh.
Yeah. Our long-suffering actual administrator, owner, and contributor, patron, who is looking at the issue, and it was about accessibility on the HBR website. Now, I have added as an emergency measure the accessibility.php, which gives you a list of all the links that are in the header and the footer without any CSS attached, so that people at least can get to a page. So this is spurred by the fact that Mike Ray has been going to the website, and as he mentioned in his comments, that he's basically a blind user. So obviously he can't see what we're trying to do, because, you know, he's hovering over the thing and it either makes a noise, and if it doesn't make a noise, he can't, quotes, air quotes, see it or hear it. The text-to-speech doesn't work. So basically I need to get my finger out and boot up a machine that has got 64-bit Linux so that I can run Triskel on it and do the text-to-speech stuff. But unfortunately, I'm really in the middle of an actual rebuild of the back room here, and I have no machine in which to put it on as yet. I'm going to actually, now that I think of it, I'll try that new laptop from work and see if I can I can boot it up with that. She might be no harm to run Triskel as a general. Okay, by the by, stop, focus. Okay, so what I want is people to help us out here. Also, if you're running Mac OS X, Windows, Linux, Android, BSD, enable your accessibility functions, go to the website, sighted users obviously are people who have the ability to use at least some vision. Go tell me what works, what doesn't work. If you want for reference, you can go to the accessibility.php page, and that is what should be in the main links. So if your reader is not working, then that is the reason why. So please go have a look at that. And those of you who could also tell us what is wrong with the CSS that would make it work better, please do so. If you have any suggestions about general ways of making the website better, please do so. Most of the website is still it's all not moved over to the public site, but that's something that we would do if we ever need to touch a page. That page gets moved out to the main site. So the more stuff that you can fix, the more open you're making HPR. Anything else, Dave?
I don't think so, and I think we've covered a lot, so I think that's about it. The issue you alluded to was the HPR list went through a slight hiatus and messages weren't getting out. Josh thinks he's got it fixed now, but I don't think we've sent any, nothing's come through the list since then. So just between you and me, we need to check that the list is working. But
I'm not 100% sure that the problem isn't on my side either, because I'm now getting double emails back from stuff I send out on other stuff. So it could be an issue on my side perhaps as well.
Okay.
So, but as I say, I'm like in the middle of rebuilding out here, so it's a bit messy. Everything's nothing's where it should be, Dave. Nothing's where it should be.
Well, I'll send a message to the list and just check to see how it goes through. Just to check that it's not down to you or something weird going on.
You could maybe, we mentioned in the show about the markdown thing, so maybe you might want to ask that, what people's thoughts are on how to get, what you see is what you get, and how to get the show notes to HPR in the format that people want to send it in, but maintaining the formatting that they want. So that would be a good one to actually.
Yeah, I'll get that sorted out for tomorrow, I think, if I can. Good, all right. That's everything as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, this show has gone on now for a long time, so let us stop and remember to support Free Software. Nope, wrong person. Yes, tune in tomorrow for another exciting episode of
Hacker
Public Radio. Join us now and share the software.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Informomicon Computer Club, and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.